So this is the end of Lecture 7, but we will begin by first of all seeing if there are leftover questions or issues from the previous lecture that anyone wants to raise. Yeah?
I wanted to ask something about that we talked about last time with the directed forces.
Yeah.
So we had said at one point, we were talking about the transition from feudalism to capitalism, that most of the class actors were acting out of economic interest. So capitalists were seeking to move towards capitalism because it benefited their economic interests, and peasants were opposed to it because it was against their economic interests. And so I said at one point, I said, well, then couldn't we say that the transition took place out of people acting out of their economic interest? And you said, yes, but capitalism would have only survived if it served the productive forces.
Right, so the the argument that Cohen advances is that it is not enough for something to be in the economic interest of actors to explain why it actually happens. It also has to create conditions for its own reproduction. And his claim then is that new social relations are able to stabilize because once they are in place, they unleash further development of the force of production. That's what gives those new relations the capacity to be reproduced over time. So there were interests in expanding capitalism by various merchant forces and proto-capitalist things for a very long time. But that would not have been enough in this rendering of historical materialism. That would not have been enough to secure the reproduction of capitalism unless it was also the case that creating capitalist conditions would expand the capacity to produce, to appropriate surplus beyond what it had been under the old relations. Now, the reason for that is not entirely clear. You know, it's not clear why this should have a law-like character. It's a little simpler when you see juxtaposed to each other two competing relations of production. So when you tell the story of the form that capitalism has already been developing inside of feudalism, and it is demonstrating to various actors that it is indeed developing the forces of production and the capacity to dynamically expand, that's actually being demonstrated to the actors inside of the old system, then it's easier to see why it attracts allies and various other social forces, and why those political coalitions help to then stabilize it once it becomes established. Because relative to the previous social order, it generates more dynamism. Once it emerges, then it outcompetes the rivals. So the productivity enhancement enables the new social structure to outcompete the old social structure.
So two things. But that's assuming that people are going to choose an economic system based on its relationship to the productive forces. And if we already established that in the transition from feudalism to capitalism, they didn't choose capitalism because the productive forces, they chose it because of their economic interests.
Well, but they chose it because of their economic interests, but their economic interests are the way they are because of the development of the productive forces. So there's still a connection.
That's what I understand, because wouldn't it be also possible to have economic interests that serve your economic interests but don't really serve the productive forces in any way, but you're still...
Sure, you could. The interests of certain kinds of feudal lords were opposed to capitalism. The question is why they are unable to secure those interests under conditions in which feudalism is stagnant. So remember, the context for the argument is the old social relations have produced perpetual stagnation. They have fettered the development of the force of production. New social relations unbottle that. New social relations unfetter the forces of production. So that's the context in which you may have a stake in the old order, but you are unable to defend that those interests. Because the new order is going to have much more dynamic access to resources by virtue of the way those new relations develop the forces of production.
But then we could only say that capitalism continues to exist because of its development of productive forces only if there were a competing Marxist in which there isn't. Right? So it's not that people are choosing capitalism because it's
right.
an alternative.
Yes, and this is indeed one of the problems with the theory as it applies to capitalism. So we will get to the special theory of capitalist history, you know, later in today's session. Marx's essential argument about capitalism, though, is that eventually capitalism no longer can develop the forces of production, and there's an alternative ready at hand, which people believe will unbottle the forces of production, and they have good reasons for that belief. It's not just kind of millenarian religious beliefs. It's beliefs grounded in their lived experience inside of capitalism. And then with the appropriate collective action, they're able to break the hold of the old superstructures that stabilize the old class relations to actually forge the alternative. But that argument in classical Marxism depends upon the stagnation of the development of the force of production in capitalism. The stagnation of the force of production of capitalism would not trigger a struggle for the transformation of capitalism if there was indeed no alternative that people could either imagine or was in place in embryonic form. So I think the actual details of the story do require that an alternative that would unbottle the relations of production be present, either in the sense of partially created already, or in the sense of people feeling strong commitments towards it. Any other thoughts from the previous? All right, so let me just, again, I know this may be unnecessarily repetitive here. Just once more, just checking to be sure. Okay, we've got now 7 minutes of successful recording, so I think my anxiety level that I'm not, in fact, doing this can be reduced. All right, let me just remind everybody where we're at and why this is relevant. The basic problem is to think about whether or not we can create, or in the sense that Marx attempted, a grand theory of the overall trajectory of human history. There are two forms of this grand theory, what could be called the general theory, which traces human history from its earliest stages, its earliest primordial past, through the present, and points towards a future. So it does make strong predictions about the future. But it's a general theory in the sense that the mechanisms and arguments apply to the entire trajectory of history. It's a single theory. Evolutionary theory has that character. It's a single theory. You may have special theories of the age of dinosaurs that refer to the particular selective processes that were in play in that ecology. But it's not the case that all of the details of the theory are the same for the Pleistocene as the Jurassic as the current period. And certainly in the current period, evolutionary biology does take into account the distinctive features of human adaptations in shaping the ecology of other species. So the idea that we're in an era of mass extinction now, that's the result of the action of the dominant species, that's new to evolution. There have been mass extinctions, I don't know, 6 or 7 times in the history of life on Earth. This is the first one that is plausibly caused by one of its species. Now, that's clearly a distinctive feature of the present period, but it's a feature that fully falls within the framework of the overall theory. It doesn't require a different theory of evolution to understand this. It's just a specificity of the current era with respect to that general theory. So the first type of theory of history is of that character. Can we construct one in which capitalism just represents a specific phase within this larger theory? And the second type of theory is one that says, no, we can't accomplish that goal. That's simply beyond our theoretical capacities. Perhaps in principle we can't. But we can develop a theory of capitalism's history. So that's a distinctive special theory of the dynamics, laws of motion, developmental trajectory of capitalism, which enables us to get traction on the destiny of this particular kind of social system, even if it doesn't constitute simply a specification of some broader historical materialism. Now, we're dealing in the previous lecture, in the first part of this one, with the structure of this broader theory of history. That's the one that Cohen is trying to lay out. The broader historical materialism is the version of a grand theory of history that animated a lot of communist ideology, and by virtue of the connection between communist ideology and Marxist social science, it influenced a lot of Marxist theory as well in the 20th century, in the late 19th and through the 20th century. And again, I think that this broader theory has significant problems, which we were outlining last time. The way I was proceeding was to raise five different criticisms and talk about the kind of response that one could make to those criticisms. Now, I should make it clear that these are responses that keep the discussion alive. That is, the criticisms are not knocked down once and for all. Now we've shown that this is a theoretical line that shouldn't be pursued. They are responses that keep the discussion alive, but they're not always entirely convincing. The last one we discussed was economic reductionism, the restrictive versus inclusive historical materialism. So Cohen's response to the criticism, aha, you're explaining history, all of society, all of historical development by a single causal process, which we can call either technological reductionism or economic reductionism, depending upon whether you're talking about the forces of production argument or the relations of production argument. Remember, there are these two types of explanations. Well, Cohen's move with respect to that criticism is to say, whoa, wait a minute. We're not trying to explain everything. That would be inclusive historical materialism, and that's clearly an impossible theory. It's clearly absurd to imagine that everything that's non-economic can be explained by the economy. We're only trying to explain those non-economic facts which are necessary for the reproduction of economic structures. So we're only engaging in an account of an explanation of the superstructure, but the superstructure is not coterminous with everything that's not economic. The superstructure are only those non-economic relations, institutions, structures, only those which are functionally necessary for the reproduction of the economic base. And then the proposal is those attributes we can explain functionally. And that's called restrictive historical materialism. Now, that's at least renders the theory plausible. It's not absurd to imagine that we could have a theory of those non-economic structures which are functional for the economy, in which we explain them functionally. Right? That's Cohen's proposal, restrictive historical materialism. That's a response that keeps the discussion going. I don't think it's entirely satisfactory. It tends to imply too strong a kind of organic view of the way societies work, in which these superstructural elements somehow are called forth by the nature of the economic requirements, as opposed to seeing societies and their the relationship between the economic structures and the conditions of existence of those economic structures, that is, these superstructures, seeing this relation as a much more partial, incomplete, muddling through, loosely coupled system. in which it's quite contingent the extent to which superstructures are actually reproducing the bases, and the system is much more prone to dysfunctions rather than functional coherence, and that the system remains in place not because everything functionally fits, but because of the balance of forces of contending actors. Now, a view that sees the system as reproduced primarily through the exercise of power by motivated actors that are trying to keep things on track is really a rather different kind of argument from this functional explanation where the system is kept in place because the parts fit together in a nice set of complementarities where one functionally produces and reproduces the other. But that's the issue of the third criticism. The fourth criticism centers around the problem of transformation. Even if relations do fetter the forces of production, there is no reason to suppose that there will always emerge any historical agents capable of transforming those relations. So the story of historical materialism, as told in the general theory, imagines two things, one of which has more plausibility than the other. So the first thing that's argued is that eventually the relations of production impose barriers to the development of the forces of production, barriers which are called fetters, and which render the forces of production stagnant. They no longer can develop under the existing relations of production. So let's call that the kind of permanent stagnation thesis. That's one argument. The second argument is that under those conditions, eventually, social forces emerge with sufficient capacity to dislodge the existing ruling classes. Now that latter point seems to me wishful thinking, that there's no general abstract theoretical reason to believe that even with a long enough time horizon, there will inevitably emerge social forces capable of transforming those relations which block the forces of production. It would be as if in evolutionary biology, before there were creatures that could fly, we said inevitably, eventually, there will be a mutation that will enable animals to fly. Well, there'd be no reason whatsoever to believe that until after it happens. And it could be the case that the nature of the prior biological architecture and the prior path-dependent nature of our DNA was such that there could be no set of mutations that could enable animals to fly. It turns out that there was, but evolutionary biology does not imagine that just because we can imagine a better creature with more adaptive capacities, that it will eventually emerge. There's no theory that the mutations are called forth to produce the necessary changes. Yeah. So that would imply a much stronger motivation than the theory of the tendency of the forces of production to develop suggests. Because the theory of the forces of production to develop as a trans-historical human capacity just means that when we do stumble upon improvements, we will adopt them rather than reject them. But not that we have some incessant drive which leads us to look for improvements. In the stagnation of the forces of production, people would not see possible improvements in the forces of production because they would all be blocked, right? So except for trivial kinds of changes, there wouldn't be a sense that they could be unblockable. Because remember that the human intelligence has to, in this case, diagnose the cause of the blocking of the forces of production by a set of social relations and their accompanying superstructures. People would have to realize that that was the problem. And there's no reason to imagine that people would just stumble upon that insight, because the problem is the prevention of the emergence of forces of production that don't exist. You know, so it's a pretty powerful set of ideas you'd have to have in your heads. Aha, I see the class relations around here are preventing something from happening that isn't happening, namely the development of the forces of production. So, and then furthermore, even that doesn't say that I would have a capacity, even remotely, to form collective action capacities to overthrow a dominant class that's benefiting just fine from the existing stagnant control over the forces of production. So I'm not saying that under specific conditions we couldn't develop such a theory. It's just hard to imagine how you could derive it from first principles. You know, from these very abstract principles that Cohen is laying out, it seems pretty hard how you could derive an inherent tendency for the transformative capacities to emerge when the forces of relations are blocked by the relations of production, unless there's other things in the theory besides those two elements. So you'd have to have the kind of theory that the special theory of capitalist history tries to do, which is a theory about why it is indeed that the working class becomes stronger and stronger as the capitalist system becomes more and more stagnant. So the theory of capitalist history tries to produce precisely that, a theory of how class capacities grow more or less in sync with the crisis-ridden and stagnation-prone character of the social structure within which classes exist. But that's an additional kind of argument. That's a specific argument about the growth of class capacities, not simply an argument about under the conditions of fettering, classes will emerge. And the process by which class capacities increase for challenging classes in capitalism and the way they increase for challenging classes in feudalism are completely unrelated to each other. That is, it's not that these are two accounts of class capacities that are derived from some singular set of general mechanisms. They're entirely different kinds of arguments. And that's why I personally think that the transformation thesis in Cohen and the idea that the class capacities for transformation develop as needed for the transformation of relations just doesn't have credibility to it. The response then is a different kind of response. It's a response that says, no, we can't really then develop a theory of historical trajectory. All that we could do is develop a theory of historical possibility. That is, we could say that there are structurally possible alternatives to the existing relations of production. They're structurally possible once they fetter the relations of production, the forces of production. But they may or may not be actually historically accessible, because there may or may not be any agents endogenously generated inside of the old social structure capable of reaching those alternatives. But the alternatives, if they could be reached, so this is a kind of counterfactual statement, if they could be reached, would have the character of unbottling the relations of production, the forces of production. So you can make that kind of historical potential or historical possibility argument. That's a much weaker, although not vacuous, kind of theory. But I don't see how a general theory of class capacities, of collective agency, how that at that level of abstraction is possible. Now, when I say that I don't see how it's possible, I don't mean the stronger claim that I see how it's impossible. is I'm not making what economists would call an impossibility theorem. There are times when social science and natural science develops a strong enough set of views that they can posit what's called an impossibility theorem. When you develop an impossibility theorem, that's a very strong claim that certain things simply are, certain kinds of theoretical arguments simply can't be made coherent. And therefore, the search for them should be abandoned. I would come relatively close to that. You know, my intuitions are that it's impossible to develop a general theory of history in which a set of singular causal mechanisms explain the entire trajectory of human history, and then all the details are just specifications and complexities. I am close to feeling that that's true, but I don't feel like I can make the next step and say, yes, definitively, there's no possibility of such a theory. And in my skepticism, the transformation thesis, the actual process by which you break through barriers, seems to me one of the key issues. But as I said, I am prepared, and so this may be my gullibility too, you know, I am persuaded about the possibility of a theory of history that gets us as far as capitalism. That a general theory that gets us as part of capitalism in the following sense. Just, I'm now repeating something I said before. If we had 1,000 planets like Earth with this basic kind of ecology, and on all of them, through biological, non-social evolution, a intelligent creatures emerged with the Cohen specifications, they live in a world of scarcity, they're intelligent and rational, you know, those three conditions. If those three conditions exist, on all 1,000 planets, you'll eventually get capitalism. Right? So, barring, if an asteroid hits the planet at some point and destroys all life, you won't, but barring something which short-circuits the whole process, kills off the whole causal structure, you will get capitalism eventually on all 1,000 planets. It could take 20 million years of intelligent, creative, scarcity coping creatures on one planet and 100,000 years on another. We seem to be in the 100,000 year planet, and some maybe 10,000 years. So I don't have any time scale for this. But eventually you'll get capitalism in all of them. If they all start with hunting and gathering, because that would be the biologically given evolutionary starting point for intelligent creatures who then become tool makers and culture makers. So if they all start as hunting and gathering communities with extended family, community-based solidarities and cooperation, and they all end up capitalist, they're not going to go from that first form of social organization to the capitalist form in one leap. There has to be some intermediate, and that intermediate will have some kind of class structure. And there you've got the three stages of Cohen. As a deterministic trajectory, in which there are two transitions, from pre-class to pre-capitalist and from pre-capitalist to class. So I'm prepared, my intuitions correspond to that predictive structure. And I think the argument about the capacity of surplus production being then capitalized to create class structures does account for that first transition. That seems like a good theory of that first transition. It may be hard to get data to definitively establish it, but that surplus capacity producing, and then eventually a community taking advantage of that, and then becoming much more productive and able to subordinate other communities, that seems like the right kind of story for the first transition. And then the second transition has something to do with in which the rigidity of those coercive extractive systems eventually begins to constrain a more dynamic form that's emerging within them, that is capitalist, proto-capitalism emerges within those coercive structures. And then at some point, that destroys the integrity of the pre-capitalist class relations. And that gives you the second transition, the transition to capitalism. Whether that transition occurs through violent revolutions or through incremental metamorphosis, that I don't think we can have a general theory of. I don't know exactly how it would happen. But that there would be such a transition, and it would be driven by the enhanced productive capacity of capitalism, and thus its ability to mobilize greater surplus for more specialized activity, and therefore capacity to compete with other social forms, that seems to me entirely plausible. That gets us to capitalism, but not before, not beyond. All right, that was probably the third repetition of that same point I think I've made in each of the last three lectures. I've given that overall architecture again. I trust that professors always have these, even experienced professors have these anxieties, right? Whether I'm being too repetitive or whether reiterating these things as we move further along actually helps to reinforce the overall conceptual structure. Obviously, I think it's doing the latter, otherwise I wouldn't do it. But occasionally I get some grumpy student who says, come on already, we've already heard that, let's get on with business. So you have my permission to be the grumpy student who says I'm being too repetitive about this. That's the only way I can figure it out is if somebody tells me if I'm becoming tedious in my repetition of the same points. Yeah. I was afraid, oh my God, he's going to. He's taking me up on my offer.
It's actually from what you just said, so that was that repetition brought this thought.
That's its point, yeah. Capitalism did develop within the womb of feudalism, but it just took over not because of productive forces, but for other reasons. Right. So that's exactly right. So my basic intuition that in all thousand planets you get capitalism does not yet validate the historical materialist claim in the way that Cohen argues, that at its core this is all anchored in the development of the forces of production. So actually what we have is really, we have two large-scale trajectories over time. We do observe that capitalist economies have much higher levels of development of productive forces than hunting and gathering societies. And that early capitalism quickly outpaced late feudalism in its productive forces. So we observe a trajectory of productive forces that corresponds to this three-stage view of history up to capitalism. And then the historical materialism argument is that the directionality and cumulative character of the former is what makes ultimately inevitable the latter. The critique then you have to be careful about the critique. There's different ways. It could be that military competition in feudalism is what ultimately raises the costs of the feudal social structure so high, and that it's military technology that improves, that makes for more intensified forms of military competition. So it's not productive forces in general, it's the production of military forces that's really going on. And that explains the development of proto-capitalism, that the driving force is warfare, not class struggle, not class relations, not surplus extraction, but warfare. And that warfare explains the development of the forces of production and the moribund quality of existing relations of production. So that proto-capitalism turns out to be a better structure for waging war because it provides a bigger surplus that can fuel the military machine. And so you can have a war and proto-state formation theory that takes you from hunting and gathering to capitalism. Because the same thing you can say about those early societies. There was the analog to war between hunting and gathering communities. There were territories of hunting and gathering. There were better or worser places to live. There was that kind of conflict. Once those communities began to store grain and have domesticated animals, war started to have more stakes. You could raid cattle. You could steal corn. Communities needed to have a surplus to protect their animals and corn and to raid others. They discovered that if they moved to fluvial plains, they could really do this with a vengeance. And then they figured out that as long as they're stealing cattle and corn, they might as well steal people too. And suddenly they get slavery. But it's all in the service of war making. So there is another way of telling the story. But it turns out that that other way of telling the story isn't all that different in the end, because it still hinges on the surplus extracting capacity of these new technologies, not just the war-making capacity per se, right? So it's still closely bound up with the surplus extraction problem, since getting more surplus is what enables you to pay for these bigger armies or these bigger warrior classes or whatever it is. There could be different versions. I consider those different versions of historical materialism. That is, the productive forces argument that Cohen has doesn't really make mention of warfare. Other productive forces arguments see warfare as the key issue. Those are different theories. You know, I wouldn't say that they constitute the same account. But they are they're closely allied theories. Neither of them relies on some endogenous dynamic of culture, for example. Neither of them says there's something about the culture that gets produced in human societies that propels a trajectory from hunting and gathering to feudalism to capitalism on all 1,000 planets. They're all material. They're both the war-making version and the class exploitation principle arguments. They're both materialist. And culture enters in the service of those explanations rather than as the primary driver. It's a really interesting exercise to think about the difference between a war-centered view, which I think is totally credible. You know, I don't have a strong basis in a sense, I would prefer the non-war-making one. It's a more benign one, but, you know, theoretical preference for why war-making couldn't be the real bottom line of what's driving these systems forward, rather than surplus extraction for rooted in class relations themselves. I think these are closely related. It's really interesting to think about the difference. War and war-making, this is a very big irony of contemporary social theory, is actually a pretty marginal theme in sociology. It's pretty extraordinary how marginal militarism and war and organized violence is, given how pervasively important it is in human history. And given that the story, the narrative story we tell of human history is all a story about war. You know, the classic narratives of the last 2,000, 3,000 years are all about conquest, warrior classes, subordinations, warfare, the myths of our societies, the heroes. I mean, all these things are so symbolically laden around war. And yet, in sociology, war is a pretty peripheral theme. You know, it figures in particular explanations, but it's not a big part of historical sociology. An exception, for those of you who are interested in these things, the work of Michael Mann. He has a four-volume book. I think the latest volume is just about out, called The Sources of Social Power. He places war absolutely at the center of the one of the four pillars of his overall argument about historical transformation. Yes, Mitch.
So you said that this perspective doesn't assume that there's something inherent in culture that drives humans or intelligent beings toward capitalism. But doesn't it assume or imply something inherent in interest even at the expense of exploiting others, isn't that kind of it's a very Hobbesian kind of perspective
right.
on human nature. Right?
So it's a very, very thin view about human nature. We're rational and intelligent, and we live in a world of scarcity. So the intelligence means we can solve problems and invent new things and figure out new ways of doing things. The rationality means that we can cope with scarcity by satisfying our needs. And the rationality and the intelligence go together to give you the development of the forces of production, right? So it's not that there is anything in human culture that gives us a drive to exploit others, per se. There's, in the Cohen view, there's something in human nature which gives us a drive to satisfy our needs through the creative and rational transformation of nature. But because we live in communities in which we do that cooperatively, it turns out that's a good way of doing it. So the hunting and gathering societies of this pre-class character turn out to be, given rationality, intelligence, and scarcity, a really good way of surviving. We develop these solidarities, and then we bump up against other communities. Now, one view is it does require a thicker theory of human nature to explain why, when communities in adjacent territories come into conflict over hunting and gathering, over cattle or whatever, one of the options they consider is stealing from the other. So we have to be certainly willing to do that. That's a pretty small step, I think. It doesn't require an inherent motivation of callousness or, you know, antipathy. I think the solidarities, the problems of trust, you know, who you have confidence in, the fact that there are scoundrels everywhere, you know, even tight hunter-gatherer societies have malingerers, so every culture has a problem, knows that there's a problem of getting people to do their fair share and to do what they're supposed to do. And so there are all sorts of cultural things that develop as part of that solidarity structure. Well, it's not such a big leap to see why that generates zones of conflict between those communities without positing a stronger view, right? The will to dominate or something like that.
But isn't it also not such a strong leap to say that in 1 out of 1,000 cases, the groups might decide to work cooperatively rather than competitively?
My view is that that there'd be huge amounts of cooperation between communities and some non-cooperation. And the question is whether the non-cooperation ends up undermining the cooperation. So there is, for those of you interested, there's a very interesting strand of theoretical work in what's called evolutionary game theory, in which one of the problems is the hawks and doves problem. If you have a community that's very willing to share and cooperate with others and one that's not, so if you have 50 communities and there's one that's not willing to cooperate and all the others are altruistic and prepared to cooperate, do the hawks drive out the doves? Right? And under what conditions do they do? And you can model this and show that it takes pretty weak conditions for the hawks to win. And one of the conditions is if being a hawk makes you a stronger hawk. That is, if there's a spiral that occurs. And I think that's a pretty plausible story. And you get double evolution going on here. Within group solidarity and out group hostility is the kind of equilibrium. That there are huge payoffs within a group having solidarity, so that the internal hawks get marginalized. That is, the people who don't reciprocate inside of a tight network get marginalized. But between groups, the costs of trusting the strangers when they're not trustworthy are very high compared to the costs of not trusting them when they are trustworthy. And that asymmetry will tend to produce in-group, out-group conflict. That's the kind of argument that leads to you don't need to specify much about human nature. You know, you'd have to make a really strong claim about human nature to avoid this, namely that people are driven towards altruism per se and are averse to conflict as part of our nature, not as... And one could imagine a species, you know, it's possible there could be on one of these thousand planets, in addition to rationality, intelligence, and scarcity, there might be deep aversion to conflict. Conceivably, that could have been part of the evolutionary starting point. And it's possible under those conditions you wouldn't get capitalism. One of the reasons for this kind of exercise, so what are we doing here? What we're doing here is a practice of theory construction, right? So, you know, you may not know it, but this is exactly what theory construction is. I say something, Mitch proposes an alternative model, I reply with evolutionary game theory and its achievements in defining hawks and doves, and then we come down to say, aha, the whole game requires that we have some motivational starting points, and one could imagine an alternative species on one of my thousand planets that has that different starting point, and then maybe the game wouldn't unfold. Yeah.
So if you buy into evolutionary game theory, doesn't then that undermine the capacity for sustaining socialism? You know, so if you have a theoretical society where, you know, it's very altruistic and people work cooperatively, and you have one group that's not, even if you tried to create something like that now, even if you had a really committed base to doing things that way, provided the rest of the world's not that way, is it?
Well, that's an interesting question. My own view is that there are very weak implications for how you would actually organize a society from all this stuff. Because the assumption is that people aren't reflexive, that they don't realize these problems, and they don't get around and say, okay, we have to create institutions to prevent the bad spirals, the vicious circles from occurring. But we are. And among other things, evolutionary game theory alerts us to the fact that we can't, that probably an anarchist view, which says let's just let 1,000 communities operate autonomously and just have them form whatever interconnections with others they want, without any superordinate authority to establish the rules of the game and to set parameters, probably the anarchist vision of a post-capitalist world is not a viable one. So evolutionary game theory might inform that, but it doesn't inform the very strongly, at least, the question of what kinds of new institutions could we build to prevent the self-destructive tendencies, to keep the hawks in check.
Yeah. And also, with the development of the forces of production to a certain level, you were talking about the costs and benefits. So once the force of production reaches a certain level, the cost of trusting someone and having that trust, say, broken. Once the forces of production have reached a certain point, the cost of that trust being broken would no longer be as high compared to the benefits of trusting someone. So when once you reach a certain, once the force of production developed, wouldn't socialism then become, socialism and trusting other communities become the viable option?
Well, that's a super interesting question. You know, it's something really to just think about without data, and then to think about it with data, so to speak. What are the conditions under which spontaneous trust is the reasonable default solution? And under what conditions would it be easier or harder to create the default solution? So, highly developed forces of production means that we can produce a huge amount of surplus, a huge amount of stuff, with relatively little labor. That's what it means. Is that a sufficient description of the situation to say that the default of trust is less risky? Well, I think you have to at least add the forms of inequality around which that productivity is used before you get there. And furthermore, even in a high productivity, high prosperity world, there are still, there can still be big advantages to somebody accumulating more wealth than they need because of the way wealth enables them to have power. And I'm not sure that trust and opportunism and all these things necessarily become become a less severe intrinsic problem. They may become a less severe practical problem if we've got the right institutions in place. But I'm not sure that they, without specifying those institutions, they would be a less severe problem. it's 5 to 11. What I'd like to, I think I can wrap up lecture 7 and then we can take our break. And then I think also lecture 8 is more compact in some ways, although I'll probably be wrong in that, in that prediction. So let's just finish up the general historical materialism story. So what we just did is transformation criticism, and I think it's a pretty significant criticism. The capacity to transform the system does not seem to me have any inherent reason to be triggered, even in the long run, by stagnation. You need more to the theory before you're going to get the capacity to transform. And certainly to, the capacity to transform into something better, you know, the capacity to transform into something which could even be worse might, on the general view that nothing stays the same forever, you know. So let me just, actually, this is a footnote. There is a very, very, very thin view of history. So this is an even thinner history, which nothing stays the same forever, right? So one argument for why capitalism is not the end of history is that nothing stays the same forever. So capitalism isn't going to be here 100,000 years from now just because nothing is going to be here. That's the same as anything recognizable 100,000 years from now. That's not an interest. I don't think that's an interesting argument because it doesn't give you any clues about what the successor stage would be. The only theory of the demise of capitalism that has some relevance is one that says at least something about what's going to come after. If all that we have as our theory is that any social structure of organization is doomed because everything is doomed. We've got a kind of everything is doomed theory. To me, that's not interesting. Sometimes that comes close to the way Marxists seem to be arguing that. Capitalism is an historically specific historical form. It hasn't been here forever, therefore it won't be here forever. The transformation thesis is an attempt to go beyond that, to give us an account of a particular trajectory beyond capitalism, not just the simplest of facts that capitalism is doomed because everything is doomed. Okay, finally, functional explanations. well, we've talked a lot about functional explanations and what how peculiar they are and how intriguing. So they are, and how they're peculiar, they're intriguing, they're slippery, and they're often cheap. That is, I think human beings probably, you know, I'm prepared to say this is probably neurologically rooted in some hardwired sense. We want to find meanings in things. We want to find purposes. And functional explanations give you a purpose. What's the role of the state? Right? What's the purpose of the sun? As a meaning-creating sentient beings, we create purposes, and functional explanations are the kind of scientific fallout of that internal, that impulse. I disagree with Jan Elster that because of those tendencies, therefore they're necessarily or virtually always illegitimate in social science. I think functional explanations are legitimate in social science. But I would modify it in a couple of ways from the way it appears in Cohen's rendition. I don't think that functional explanations plausibly yield a prediction of optimality. That is, that the superstructures that exist because they are the optimal ones for reproducing the base. That just doesn't seem plausible, why there should be any tendency towards optimality. Now, there are special cases where one might imagine that, although even in the special cases, it's a little far-fetched. In capitalist competition among firms, we might say that on that we predict the business strategies of firms to be the optimal ones for maximizing their profits. Why? Because if they weren't the optimal ones for maximizing the profits, those firms would disappear. Well, I still think the optimal claim is not very plausible. I like to substitute what I call functional compatibility to optimality is the central explanatory logic of a functional explanation. That is, the superstructures exist because they're good enough to reproduce the base. They may be quite suboptimal. That is, we might be able to easily imagine better structures that were even historically accessible, not just better in our imagination. They were historically on the table. They just lost. They got ruled out. There could be ways of organizing elections and banking systems that would be better for American capitalism than the ones we have. And they might have even been historically achievable at some points, but they just lost in the struggles over how to design institutions. And that's because the struggles over how to design institutions come out of interests, not functions. That is, it's power struggles among interested actors who are trying to create institutions that are best for them, not best for the system, but best for them, that determines what actual institutions we have. But the functional compatibility thing says, if those solutions are not themselves compatible with reproducing social relations, then they're unlikely to remain in place. What functional compatibility says is, it's a prediction about where you get institutional instability. You get institutional instability when the design of institutions or policies, however much they serve particular interests of particular powerful actors or other actors, when you get institutions that serve interests but which are disruptive for the reproduction of capitalist class relations, those institutions will become unstable. They'll be the object of attack. And the prediction is they'll be transformed. So functional compatibility is a way of thinking about what triggers transformations of institutions, rather than saying that what you end up with is in some way optimal. It means that you don't have quite as clear predictions about what comes out of such disruption, but functional compatibility seems to me still a functionalist explanation and a good enough one for a lot of purposes. Lachelle. Yeah, right. All right, well, that wraps up Lecture 7. We're a little bit after 11. I think it's time for our break, and when we return, we'll go right into the specific history of capitalism's futures. During the break, one other question was asked, which I think is relevant to our grandiose ruminations about the full trajectory of human history. So Cohen's characterization of human beings as rational and intelligent is an extremely thin description. And he would certainly not claim that this is an adequate characterization of human beings. A clearly important additional element, and there's many others that we could add, would be, for example, that human beings are meaning seekers, that it's part of our evolutionary heritage. This is what we're hardwired to make sense of the world in terms of its meanings, not just in terms of how it can help us solve practical problems, that's the intelligent bit, that enable us to survive in our environment better. That's the rational bit, right? So we're also meaning seekers. And it's pretty hard to imagine how you could end up with the kind of religions we have in the world and the sorts of beliefs and symbols and myths that they involve if you didn't think that we were meaning seekers. You know, all the content and aesthetics and all these features of religion are rich with ways of endowing lives with meaning. Furthermore, there's a lot of other things we would have to be. You know, if you want to say what kind of creatures would we have to have all this stuff, clearly there's something like an inherent aesthetic capacity or drive. Art is a transhuman phenomenon, decorating, making things beautiful, is trans-historical. There's no culture in which people don't decorate. And that's also bound up with religion. If you want to explain religion, certainly it has to do with how to make images powerful, emotion-laden. And so there's all these other things about us. We're clearly emotion-laden creatures as well as rational and intelligent. So this very thin account is not meant to be an adequate account of human nature to explain all the things we might want to explain. It's meant to be, it's asking a much narrower question. What are the properties of human nature needed to give us history and historical trajectory, which we can then make theoretical sense of? So in a way, what Cohen is saying is, regardless of your views about how salient our meaning-seeking capacities are, you don't need to invoke it in order to understand why in all thousand planets you get capitalism. All you need is the rationality and intelligence elements. Now, to explain why religion plays such an important role in the superstructure, you need more than that. Why is it that religion, rather than other forms of ideology, play such an important role in stabilizing class relations? For that, you need more than just the view that we're rational and intelligent. You need an account of why we hold the kinds of beliefs we have, and meaning-seeking, and fear of death, and all the other stuff that, you know, is bound up with the religious dimension of culture would have to be part of explaining why religion plays that role. You know, when Marx says religion is the opium of the people, it's just, the context makes that a slightly distorted account of his view, because he also gives a richer account of how religion provides solace in a world of pain. You know, it's not just opium, but that sentence only makes sense because we're because we're meaning seekers, and that's why we're perhaps vulnerable to certain kinds of myths as a way of coping with the tragedies of our lives. So it's just important, it's really important not to misrepresent and misunderstand the character of the argument. A lot of the hostility of the non-political hostility, of the purely intellectual hostility to historical materialism, comes from an incorrect assumption that it strips human beings down to this bare bones, rational, intelligent actor. And it's just a misfired criticism, because it leaves out what it is precisely that's trying to be explained. And that is this overall trajectory. Now, as I've said, I don't think it works entirely for that, even for that purpose. But it's not it's not far-fetched. It's not kind of an absurd argument with respect to what it's trying to explain. All right. Well, if we don't think that you can get an account of the history of the future just from historical materialism at this more abstract level, because, among other things, the transformation theory just doesn't work, what we really need then is a specific theory of capitalist history. And that's really, in any case, where the high stakes are located. That's the theoretical ambition that would, if it were satisfactory, be a terrific aid to any transformative project. So whether you would buy into everything about Marxism, it would certainly be fantastically helpful to know something specific about the future trajectory of capitalism. Now, remember how I posed that problem in my Elements of a Theory of Transformation, where I said any full-bore, complete theory of transformation, of emancipatory transformation, would have to have the four basic components. It needs a theory of social reproduction, that's the barriers to transformation. It needs a theory of the contradictions in the mechanisms of reproduction. That is why the barriers still have cracks, contradiction spaces, why you can do something in spite of the barriers. And then what you'd really like is a theory of the trajectory into the future of both barriers and contradictions. Right? So we know what we have to contend with now. We'd like to know what we are going to have to contend with 20 years from now, where what we have to contend with in the future is a consequence both of the existing barriers and contradictions and the cumulative effect of the unintended consequences of the strategies of actors given those barriers and contradictions. That would give us some account of future barriers and contradictions. That, if we really had that in play, then we could answer the strategic question, what is to be done? Because we would know not merely what is to be done in the here and now, but how should we sequence the what is to be done with respect to this unfolding of a trajectory into the future. That's a tall order. That third component is a really tall order. The first two are hard enough, a theory of reproduction, a theory of the contradictions and gaps in reproduction. Those are tough things to really lay out as well. A theory of what are the strategies in the here and now given the existing relations of barriers and contradictions, that's also hard, but tractable. But what the cumulative trajectory of unintended consequences, the things that happen behind our backs, that's a very tall order to produce. Well, but you can see why if you could do it. It would be great. It would be in huge service of revolutionary transformative movements. The real background premise of all of this is that if on the basis of our diagnosis and critique of the existing society, we believe that there are huge harms generated by existing institutions, that oppression is hardwired into the existing social structure. It's not just an accident. It's built into the way things are. And we have an emancipatory project. We want to transform those structures precisely because they produce such harms. So if that's what our motivations are, then there's one additional element you need before all of this becomes this big headache and problem. You have to believe that human emancipation is not going to happen by accident. You know, it's not just going to be the willy-nilly byproduct of what we do. The willy-nilly byproduct of what we do might make it easier or harder to transform systems of oppression. But the systems of oppression are only going to be transformed under conditions in which people organize collectively with the purpose of their transformation. Human emancipation has to be a project. It's not going to be simply something that happens behind our backs. But nevertheless, lots happens behind our backs. Lots of things are the byproducts of our actions. And so a theory of transformation has to worry about that as well. But the background assumption about all this, which, you know, conceivably is wrong, it's possible that just through the slow incremental improvement of forces of production and their ramifications behind the backs of actors, suddenly the world will become more benign. And these oppressions and hardships and harms will just gradually attenuate. They'll loom less large in the lives of people. I don't believe that. I think it requires collective action and struggle with the purpose of transformation. In a way, if you want to ask what is one of the very bottom line Marxian intuitions about the world, that I would identify as one. You know, that human liberation and emancipation comes through struggle, where that is a purpose of the struggle. Okay, so given all that, we want a theory of the trajectory of capitalism's futures, and that's what Marx attempts to do, very ambitiously. And I think this part of the theory is more persuasive than the general historical materialism, because in this part of the theory, there really is the elaboration of mechanisms. And indeed, there's an elaboration of mechanisms which conform pretty strongly to Elster's demand that mechanisms have micro-foundations. So Elster, in his debate with Jerry Cohen over functional explanation, kind of relentlessly argues for the importance of micro foundations of macro theory. That macro theory can't just operate at the macro level. It needs these anchors in the motivations and strategies and actions of individual persons. That's the micro foundations. Marx's argument really does have micro foundations. Now, it may not be satisfactory for various reasons, but it does have micro foundations. So let's let's look at the argument, and then I'll try to explain some of the mechanisms involved, and then where there are problems in the explanation. And I've organized this in the form of five theses. These are exactly the same as the five theses in the chapter in Envisioning Real Utopias that deals with this theme. And as in many topics, my thinking hasn't developed much beyond where it was 2 years ago when I wrote the last words of Envisioning Real Utopias. So pretty much what I'm going to say is going to just track what I wrote there. All right, the first thesis I call the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis. In the long run, capitalism is an unsustainable economic system. Its internal dynamics, which Marx referred to as the laws of motion of capitalism, systematically undermine the conditions of its own reproducibility, thus making capitalism progressively more and more fragile and eventually unsustainable. So the long-term non-sustainability of capitalism thesis could also be called the long-term intensification of vulnerability thesis. Capitalism becomes more and more vulnerable to challenge. It doesn't become stronger and stronger over time, more and more robust. It becomes weaker and weaker, more fragile. This prediction, I think, is based on four observations about empirical trends, which Marx observed in the 19th century, combined with an underlying theoretical argument about the mechanisms which drive those trends. Now, in a way, Marx's predictions here have quite a similarity in a certain respect to the current debates about global warming. Right, so how does the discussion of global warming proceed? I'm not going to talk about the scientific grounding in the actual mechanisms, but the kind of logic of the inquiry. So what we've observed are trends over the last 100 years. And we can chart those trends. We can chart the trends in average surface temperature as best we can. We can chart trends of those surface temperatures at different points. We can chart trends of the melting of glaciers. And we can track further back through ice cores, what the temperatures were in the past. We can also track trends of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere because of ice cores and other mechanisms. So we've got a set of data that goes from some point in the past to the present. We want to project data into the future, which are all predictions. And there are two kinds of trends we want to project into the future. CO2 concentrations into the future, and temperature into the future. These are the two pivotal trends that we want to project into the future. Now, we know that there are complicated feedback processes. That's why it's a problem. So as CO2 rises, and as temperature rises, ice melts, ice reflects heat more than ground. So when the ice melts, the temperature is going to rise more rapidly than it would have risen just because of higher CO2 concentrations. Right? So it's not enough to simply predict temperature from the CO2 concentration. There's these other things that happen. Right? So you got all these feedback problems. So what the scientists do is they create a bunch of computer modeling. They have a bunch of theories about the causal connections between all these things, about the strength of the feedback mechanisms. They create computer models. And what the computer models do is the following. You create a computer model, and then you set the parameters back 200 years ago, and you see if the model, how well the model replicates what actually happened up to the present. Now, if you get a model that absolutely perfectly tracks all the parameters up to the present based on a causal model, you know, that actually has parameters. It's not just plugging in all the data from the present. You know, it's not like the regression problem where you've got 1,000 cases and 1,000 variables. You can always perfectly reproduce, you can explain 100% of the variance if you have as many variables as cases. So you try to have simple models that will actually track all of the parameters over the last several hundred years. If you can really do that, and then you project it out for another 100 years, you think, well, that's pretty plausible. That gives a possible future trajectory. The problem in climate science is that there are many models which track very accurately everything that's happened from 200 years to the present. And because there's nonlinear dynamics at work, the mere tracking of 200 years ago to the present doesn't guarantee tracking from now for the next 200 years, because things get crazy because of feedback and nonlinear things. And that's why there's debates. But the full bore of full range of debates still give you just a band of estimates from the most conservative, that is the one where the tracking into the future gives you the slowest rise, to the most radical. That is what Marx wanted to do for capitalism. His models are essentially computer simulations. He didn't have a computer. He had equations. They were systems of equations. He basically was making an argument about an iterated process with feedback, with nonlinearities, that would produce a particular kind of trajectory. It was based then on 4 empirical trends. I think I listed these in the chapter. I didn't reread the chapter, so I don't remember whether my notes, how well my notes track the chapter. But there's basically 4 trends. First trend, in the course of capitalist development, the level of productivity increases enormously, especially because of productivity gains from the increasing capital intensity of production. That's an empirical trend. You can look at it. You can see what the capital intensity of production is. You can see how productivity increases, and you can track that over decades. Capitalism expands relentlessly. That's another trend. More and more domains are commodified, and capitalist markets go to more and more parts of the world. That's also a trend. Bang, we can see that happening. You can document it that up to the 1860s, from as far back as data was available, capitalism has expanded by commodifying more intensively within regions of the world and extending the market to new regions. Third trend, as capitalism develops, capitalist firms become bigger and capitalist markets become more centralized. That is, they become more like big firms dominating markets rather than lots and lots of tiny firms. But that's a general trend, and in Marx's time, you could track it from the 18th through the 19th century, and it looks like firms are getting bigger and markets are getting more centralized. That means that not only is the world being more organized through markets, but these markets are being ever more dominated by giant firms. And the fourth trend is that that capitalist economies are periodically disrupted by crises. And the more recent crises tend to be more severe than the older crises. Up to the time Marx was writing Capital, it looked like crises tended to become more intense over time. Those are empirical observations. And then the question is there a theory of the laws of motion of capitalism, of its internal dynamics, which will explain all 4 of those facts, all 4 of those trends? If you can explain all 4 of them, then plausibly you can just extend it out into the future and it'll tell you something about future trends. And that's precisely what Marx tried to do. It's why the ambition in Marx's Capital is really just extraordinary. And why, as a theoretical achievement, I think it's unparalleled in 19th century thought. It's way different from kind of simple-minded models of Darwinian social, like Spencer, you know, social Darwinism of change just coming because of the survival of the fittest or something like that. It's a very deep kind of argument. The pivot of his solution to this, I think the part that's the most systematic and gives the most compelling case for all of these trends is what he calls the law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit. The law of the falling tendency of the rate of profit. Now, this is a pretty complicated set of arguments. There are huge technical debates around it. It is grounded in the labor theory of values, so it's grounded in a set of economic assumptions or assumptions about how to theorize the economy that very few economists hold to today. And many Marxist economists also no longer buy into the labor theory of value. And to fully explain this would require quite a detour into the labor theory of value. We'll be discussing the labor theory of value again very shortly when we talk about the theory of exploitation, because the labor theory of value is also the way that Marx and Marxists have elaborated the concept of exploitation. In that discussion, what I will argue is that you don't need the labor theory of value in order to have a very strong theory of capitalist exploitation. So particularly from a sociological point of view, that is from the point of view of how exploitation figures in sociological explanations, the labor theory of value is kind of redundant. It's an added layer. It can be useful, but it's not necessary. We can account for exploitation and understand why it generates certain kinds of conflicts without the labor theory of value. So I'm hesitant. You know, this has always been a tension in this class, how much time to spend in actually building the account of the labor theory of value. What I'll do, just so that this idea of the falling rate of profit makes some sense, is I'm not going to fully explain the labor theory of value, but I'll tell you what its intuition is. One just preliminary point, Marx didn't introduce the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value was just the standard way that all economists in his era thought about the value of commodities. To understand the labor theory of value, then, you need to understand this simpler notion. It's not so simple, but just the simple notion of the value of a commodity. Now, we're all familiar, everybody who lives in a market economy, is totally familiar with the notion of the price of a commodity. And we know how to compare prices. So we know that a pair of shoes that costs $100 costs twice as much as a grocery basket of pastries that cost $50. So we can compare a pair of shoes with a basket of pastries. Now, in a way, that's a kind of absurd comparison. What does it mean to say that this pair of nice shoes, or I guess these days $100 makes it just sort of average shoes, but whatever. This pair of shoes is worth the same as a basket of pastries. Now, worth the same has a well-defined meaning when worth means costs the same. Everybody knows what that means. Take out $50 rather than $100 and you've got one or the other. The idea of a theory of value is that there's some way of evaluating the value of these commodities independently of their empirical prices, which then helps to explain their empirical prices. So it's clear that what you're paying for is their prices. But when we say this is more valuable, this is twice as valuable, can we mean something other than just the empirical prices? Can we mean something about some underlying property of these things, which renders them in this ratio of 2 to 1 in this particular example, Now, surely it can't have anything to do with their physical properties. I mean, you can't eat your shoes, and if you try to wear the pastries, it's just not, you know, these are completely different use values. That's the term that's used to describe all of their physical properties. Completely unrelated, qualitatively different things. You can't even talk really about their relative value in terms of how much does it satisfy your needs. You know, they're a kind of straight utility. What does it mean? Does a pair of shoes satisfy my needs twice as much as a basket full of pastries? It's a kind of weird notion. Need satisfaction doesn't seem to have a natural metric that you can say this is twice as need satisfying just because it costs twice as much. No, none of these really seems to get at it. Now, in contemporary economics, people say, forget it. It's just prices. We've got ratios of prices. That's all we need to know. That's called a subjective theory of value. It's based on supply and demand. You assign value, and then it gets revealed by the way the market prices work. In classical economics, people said, no, there's something underlying that's generating this theory of this value. And the standard answer was, it's the amount of labor time it takes to produce them. It takes twice as much labor to produce your $100 pairs of shoes, on average, than it does to produce your grocery basket full of pastry. If you counted up all the hours involved, and that means for the pastries, the hours involved in growing the wheat and refining the wheat and baking the pastries, etc. That is all the hours embodied in producing that. And if you counted all the hours embodied in producing the shoes, then roughly speaking, there'd be twice as many hours involved on average in producing the shoes than producing the basket of groceries. Now, there's other little tweaks you have to do. It's the term that's usually used is socially necessary hours. If you're a particularly slow baker and you take five times as long to bake your pastries as anybody else, you're not going to be able to sell them at five times as much just because it embodies more labor. No, the amount of labor that your actual price will depend upon some kind of social averaging process. So that's called socially necessary labor. And then there's this added kind of wrinkle, which turns out to be a huge problem, not a little one, which is, well, some labor is incredibly skilled, and other labor is just sort of raw human labor power. Do we really want to say that something that takes 2 hours of highly skilled labor has the same value as something that takes 2 hours of completely raw, anybody can do it off the street labor? Well, no, that doesn't seem right. There's somehow more value intensity in the highly skilled labor. An hour of highly skilled labor seems to intuitively involve producing more value per hour than an hour of raw labor. And that seems like a little wrinkle. It turns out to be a hellish wrinkle to figure out what intensity means. What is the metric of highly skilled versus unskilled? How do you know something is five times as skilled? What does that mean? And it turns out if you really drive that problem all the way down to its base, you know, you really kind of work through that problem, you get into all sorts of internal inconsistencies and problems. So it's not easy to solve that problem. Some Marxists think they've solved it. Others think it's unsolvable. I don't know exactly what the story is on that. But it's another wrinkle. But for the moment, you can just forget about all that. Let's just call this abstract labor. That's the term Marx used. And a unit of abstract labor is the same no matter who produces it, no matter what it's producing. It's just an abstract notion of the expenditure of human effort. And let's ignore the skill problem and the inefficient baker problem, right? Okay, so that's the labor. That's the notion that the value of things comes from the amount of labor embodied in the things. It's an attractive idea, quite apart from whether it works from the point of view of economic theory. It has an attractive moral quality. Because ultimately, what we care about are people. What we care about are lives. The time spent in producing something is a kind of metric of how the lives of our fellow human beings, the people who we are cooperating with by consuming what they produce, how their lives are embodied in what we're consuming. And then if you are, now we're getting into moral questions, if you're a radical egalitarian and you believe all lives are of equal value, my life is of no more value than yours, my hour is of no more value, particularly my hour as a measure of my lifetime spent, then there's something deeply egalitarian and satisfying by the about the labor theory of value as a characterization of the economy that also corresponds to a certain moral view about how we should be reciprocal and how it's a matter of respect to you that I will, if I'm consuming 10 hours of your labor time, that I'm exchanging it for 10 hours of mine. That's a kind of simple egalitarian view of equal respect. So there are some very deep, I think, moral qualities to this. The trick is whether it's also explanatory. You know, it can be morally attractive. It can be a useful way of characterizing the moral dimensions of exploitation, for example, without it being explanatory. It doesn't have to be that the actual prices are regulated by embodied labor, and yet the moral character of exchange can be embodied labor. These are two separate questions. All right, so what is that's my 10-minute account of the labor theory of value. Labor time imparts to the things it produces their value, and on average, things exchange proportionate to their value. So the prices that you observe will, on average, with a bit of other details that I'm not going to talk about, be the things that be determined by labor time. Now, that understanding of the labor theory of value is what underwrites the theory of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. The rate of profit in not just Marxism, but in any theory, the rate of profit is the total, the denominator is the total costs of production. You have cost you something to produce things. And the numerator is the total surplus that you've produced. So you have the total cost of production in the denominator, and you have your profit, that is how much you've made after you've deducted. You have the total value of everything you produce. You deduct the costs. You get your profit, which is the total revenues minus the costs, right? And you divide it by the costs, and you get the rate of profit. So the total amount, the total value of everything you produce, you subtract the costs of production from the total value of what you've produced, you subtract all the costs, and you divide that by the costs, and you get the rate of profit. The numerator in that equation, Marxists call the surplus, or surplus value. You have a total value of everything that you've produced. You subtract the value of all the costs, and you're left with a excess, and that's called surplus value. Whoops, sorry. Oh, it's over there. Well, that's S. And S is divided by the total cost of production. The total cost of production consists of all the wages you've paid all your workers, plus all the things you've bought as inputs to production. That includes machines as well as raw materials. And for the machines, you know, what you have to really do is how much of the machines got used up in the production. That's called depreciation, you know, the standard way of thinking about it. So you've got surplus, that's how much is left over after you've paid for everything, and you've got all the stuff you've paid for. The Marxian terminology for that is S is the symbol for the surplus. And the denominator is your total cost of production, which is the cost of wages. That's called V. For the technical reason is V rather than W. It's because it stands for variable capital. There's no reason to worry about that. And C doesn't mean capital. It refers to constant capital. It means the inputs and machinery that you've used up. But you don't don't really have to worry about that. The key part is that the denominator is all the cost of production, C plus V. That's your rate of profit. Now, why should the rate of profit fall in the course of capitalist development? Why should that ratio get more and more adverse? Why should it be that the denominator rises more rapidly than the numerator? Well, here is the kind of simplest way of having an intuition behind the argument. Value is, remember, the value comes from the expenditure of human labor, right? It's the labor theory of value. The way to think about it is it's the living labor theory of value. It's human effort being imparted to things which imparts value. Well, the argument then is if capital intensity goes up over time, more and more of the costs of production take the form of buying machines and buying inputs rather than labor. Which means that in terms of your total cost structure, the part of your cost structure which is generating that surplus value becomes a smaller and smaller part of your cost structure. And the part of your cost structure that isn't generating new value, machinery does not create value in this framework. Only labor creates value. Machinery embodies value, but you've paid for that. You bought the machines. You paid for the value of those machines already. The price of those machines reflected that value. The price of what you sell will include a little bit that comes from the machines that you've used up, but no new value gets generated through the use of machines. The only thing which generates new value is the expenditure of human effort in the labor theory of value. So if your total costs go up because you have bigger and bigger machines, bigger and bigger factories, and labor is a smaller and smaller part of your total cost of production, then what happens is your denominator grows more rapidly than your numerator because you're only getting that numerator, that is the surplus, out of the effort of the people you're hiring with your wages. Wages are a smaller part of your total cost of production. Less labor power is being used. That's why productivity is, that's what it means in part for productivity to be going up. But this has the effect of lowering your average expected rate of profit over time. Imagine the extreme case where you have robots that are producing everything. And you have one person who comes into the factory every morning and flips the switch to turn it on and then flips the switch to turn it off at night. And the robots are self-repairing. You know, you have robots to repair the robots. And there are science fiction stories that have this character of basically a production system that doesn't require any living labor. Well, if that was actually the case, if you actually could have such a system of production, there would be virtually no profits. It would be incredibly efficient. It would be hugely beneficial to humanity because it means people wouldn't have to work. They could do all the things in life that create meaning and connectedness. They wouldn't have to spend labor to provide for their basic necessities. That would all be done by these robots. But the owners of the robots would get no return on their investment because there'd be no surplus value in the production, or just the tiniest bit. That's the intuition behind the idea that the rate of profit declines over, will have a tendency to decline over time. Capital intensity goes up, the surplus generating potential of those means of production goes down because less and less labor is being exploited. Now, there may be counter tendencies of various sorts. Those are all complications of the theory. But if these mechanisms are, in fact, in place, then there will be a long-term decline in the aggregate rate of profit. Now, that is not all that's going on, even in Marx's account of this tendency and why it creates such havoc for capitalism. In addition to this long-term tendency for the rate of profit to go down, there's fluctuations. There's business cycles that we know, that we currently have, that we all know about. You know, there's ebbs and flows. There's times when there's overproduction and then the rate of profit goes down because capitalists can't sell what they've produced. There's times when there's labor struggles and workers succeed in raising their wages, so profits get squeezed because the wage bill goes up. So there's all sorts of other things that create periodic cycles. Those are you know, the standard business cycle. But so imagine what's happening is the rate of profit is going down, and business cycles are occurring around a declining average rate of profit. What that means is that as profits get lower, when business cycles are at their bad phase, then the economy is hugely disrupted because large numbers of firms are having negative profits. A business cycle around a high rate of profit just means business is worse for firms. A business cycle around a low rate of profit means it's catastrophic for firms, and the economy becomes increasingly unstable and disrupted. So this is what really creates the intensification of vulnerability thesis, this first thesis in the theory of capitalist trajectory, that the rate of profit is declining, the amplitude of business cycles continues, but the actual experience of business cycles becomes ever worse because they're hitting the economy at a lower rate of profit. Yeah.
Excuse me, I just have a question about this law of falling tendency of the rate of profit. Doesn't capitalism have some kind of internal mechanism which, you know, which pushes it to maximize profit? So it might be in capitalism's better interest to mechanize everything, but instead of mechanizing everything, they're going to ship overseas and have, you know,
sure. So
sweatshops.
Right. So two things to note. Individual capitalists always maximize their profits, and that only makes this problem worse, not better. So that is, this is an argument about how individual capitalists are just trying to maximize their profit. If your competitor has introduced a new machine, you're forced to do so, because that competitor is going to be able to sell products for less than you if it's more productive. So you're forced to increase capital intensity. So the competitive struggle among capitalists is precisely what, behind their backs, lowers the average rate of profit, even if it increases their individual rate of profit. So it increases their individual rate of profit when they introduce the machinery, but it lowers the aggregate rate of profit over time. That's behind their backs. In response to that, capitalists may move their capital abroad and just displace this dynamic to another place. So what does that do? Well, first of all, China's would then experience over time a falling rate of profit eventually as capital intensity increases there. And you'll have even more economic disruption in the place you've left because you're actually having disinvestment there. So when you get to this lower level of abstraction where there's capital flight, there's all sorts of other complications, then the actual prediction about the rate at which the rate of profit declines becomes less clear because there's counter tendencies. For the short time, the rate of profit will go up when you move to China, but in the long term, it'll go down. I think we have to stop, and I will quickly run through the rest of this on Wednesday, and then we will discuss Arrighi's account of the trajectory of capitalism and finish up this section of the course then. Okay.